is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. For the last 10 years, the oral history project StoryCorps has been collecting interviews about people's lives. Friends and family sit down to recount important moments. David Isay is an award-winning public radio producer who launched StoryCorps in 2003.
All in all, StoryCorps has recorded close to 50,000 interviews now with about 100,000 people. So it's one of the largest, if not the largest, collection of human voices, certainly American voices, ever gathered. And in the course of doing these interviews, which folks here on Morning Edition, we decided to focus on specific groups.
That has led to the Military Voices Initiative launched last year. Selected interviews from that project are heard on Weekend Edition Saturday. Last week, StoryCorps producers came to Kalamazoo for the Military Voices Initiative. They collected stories like this one, where Don Phillips was interviewed by his son, Richard.
I had to certainly get to know your brother. He saw me. He didn't know who I was because he was so young, 3 months when I left, and I guess he would have been 9 months when I came back, and he's like, who is the stranger? And it took a little while for him to...
How did that make you feel?
Oh, that makes you feel... You understand it intellectually, but it hurts your heart.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, my son doesn't know who I am. I understand why. I've been gone. But, you know, fortunately, that changes over time.
I spoke with StoryCorps founder David Isay last week while military service members, veterans, and their families were telling their stories at WMUK's studios.
And in many ways, you know, Kalamazoo is the birthplace of this Military Voices Initiative. Because it was talking to Gordon Bolar, who runs the station, about his son, Matthew, who was killed in Iraq when we were in Kalamazoo, or we had just left Kalamazoo for our visit there, that inspired this initiative so that we could collect and honor these stories and give folks in the military, people and their family, the chance to have these conversations and leave them for history and leave memorials to loved ones who were lost, talk about what their experiences were like overseas, and so forth. You know, StoryCorps is very much a project about listening and generosity and honoring the real, authentic American story. And obviously the 2.4 million men and women who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan and the millions of families who have stood behind them are a huge part of the American story right now and of recent American history.
Do military members and their families need a place like this? Is this something that's been lacking, an opportunity for them to tell the stories about what they've experienced, maybe not just in the theater of war, but on the home front as well?
I think so. I mean, you know, I just was handed a piece of paper about the project, and I see that, you know, we were projected to record about 680 interviews over the course of the project, and I just saw that we still have 6 months to go. We've already recorded 677, which speaks to the need for families to come in and have this experience. You know, it's very similar in some ways to the 9/11 project that we did, where we'd see people come to StoryCorps who were tired of being, you know, kind of prodded by, you know, people in white lab coats and so forth and ask questions. StoryCorps is a public service, and we're there to serve the people who come to the booth. And I think that many folks in the military, you know, feel that coming to StoryCorps and telling their story with a colleague or a family member is something that they're doing for history. They know that this goes to the Library of Congress, that it becomes part of American history, that, you know, 500 years from now, their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will get to hear these stories. And while some folks may feel that going to a therapist is something they're not comfortable with, feel somehow self-indulgent, coming to StoryCorps and leaving this record to be part of American history is something that people are more comfortable with. Now, we are not therapists in any way, but it is an opportunity for people to talk, and it's an opportunity for people to be listened to. And I think that, you know, part of what's at the core of StoryCorps is that this act of being listened to by a colleague, by a friend, by a family member, you know, reminds people how much their lives matter. And people really do want to be heard and listened to and have a chance to talk about what they've experienced. I've heard from my staff that there'll be times that, you know, we'll show up at a reentry conference where folks are coming back to the States from the theater of war, and that there'll be, you know, psychologists there who are sitting in rooms and nobody wants to go talk to them, but they'll come into the StoryCorps booth and talk again because they feel that this is a contribution to American history. So this has been a great privilege of ours, and I think that doing something like the Military Voices Initiative, along with our 9/11 work, is one of the highest callings of this, you know, method we've created of giving people the chance to talk to each other and listen to each other.
When you do something like Military Voices, do you see some things that are different from sort of the original StoryCorps idea? Or is it, you know, still a very similar experience for these people of coming in, telling their story? It just happens to be about a different topic.
You know, the rule of StoryCorps is that it's 40 minutes. You know, I think what we've created is a method in some ways for people to distill their lives in 40 minutes as best that's possible. And you know, as you know from hearing these, they're often very emotional conversations. I think that what's happening with Military Voices is no different than what happens in every StoryCorps interview. I think that folks are talking a lot about their military experiences because the fact that they've just come back from service, just come back from war, is what's on their mind and what's most important to them. So the vast majority of the conversations are about their military service. And there are special questions that we give people to suggest they may want to talk about as part of the Military Voices Initiative, but people are allowed to talk about whatever they want to talk about. So there may be some just talk about family, and there may be some talk about, you know, other issues that are important, memories of teachers or whatever it is. But I think that, you know, the bulk of the interview is going to be about the military service.
Why is storytelling so important, whether it's about military experience or anything else?
Well, you know, I think of StoryCorps less a project about storytelling than about listening. And I think that the power of what happens in a StoryCorps booth and so much of what StoryCorps is about is letting someone have an opportunity to talk about what's important to them and have someone else, you know, really listen carefully to what they have to say and ask meaningful questions. And I think that, you know, that act of being listened to can often remind people that, you know, how much their life matters, you know. And there's also something certainly that speaks to mortality in StoryCorps because of the fact that these interviews are going to live on for so long. And I think that, you know, part of the power of that StoryCorps experience is people knowing that someday, you know, people will be able to listen to their voice, that they won't be forgotten. We do a lot of outreach at StoryCorps to make sure that people who might feel that their voices are least heard participate in the project. And I think that in some cases that gives that sense of, to folks who feel least heard, the idea that their story is important enough to become part of American history is the most empowering. You know, I think that this is, in some ways, this is kind of the opposite of reality TV. You know, nobody comes to StoryCorps to get rich. Nobody comes to StoryCorps to get famous. It's simply an act of generosity, and it's a very kind of pure sort of act. And I think you hear that in the stories that are broadcast every Friday. I mean, we get barraged with so many kind of negative stories and salacious stories, you know, not on public radio, but certainly in the, you know, in the news in general and on TV. And I think what we hear in StoryCorps are, you know, these are the real American stories. It's just about everyday people, whether it's, you know, Matthew Bolar, you know, serving in Iraq, or, you know, a grandmother, or, you know, a friend who's, you know, just everyday acts of courage and decency and kindness are what America is really all about. And, you know, for me, StoryCorps is very much a project about hope. And every week when I hear these stories, when my production team brings them to me, they give me hope and remind me who we really are as Americans and, you know, what our kids can and should aspire to become when they grow up, which are, you know, decent human beings.
Does oral history work better in an audio form, do you think, than it would be with cameras rolling on people?
That is a... it's a tough question. I love the audio form, and I will never. I was a radio producer before starting StoryCorps, and I think that there's just such power to the human voice. And certainly with the StoryCorps method of recording, there's just something beautiful about having microphones. You don't have to worry about, you know, cameras or lights. You don't have to worry about what you look like. You just kind of melt into each other. And then, of course, you know, I think that the soul is kind of captured in the human voice, and the power of just the human voice is just so, it's just kind of the realest, the truest manifestation of a person's being. I also really like with StoryCorps that when you listen to one of these interviews, there are no preconceived notions about the folks who are talking based on what they look like. And it's so easy for us to judge people based on how they look. And that just gets tossed out of the, you know, it just gets tossed in the trash can when you're dealing with StoryCorps. But, you know, the important thing is doing the asking and recording these things. So whether it's on a video camera or an audio, I think video can be great. It's just not our method. And I don't necessarily think that having a video camera can make people more uncomfortable. I mean, I think it's all in the asking. And if you ask if you're doing the questioning in a sincere, open, thoughtful way and you really care about what people are saying as an answer, whether you have, you know, just a pencil and a piece of paper or Klieg lights and a, you know, a huge camera, it doesn't make that much of a difference. It's about the purpose and the asking and the genuineness and generosity of the act of asking these questions.
You mentioned your career as a radio producer. As I understand it, that got started because you were trying to get media interested in a story in New York. You pitched the idea to Amy Goodman, now the host of Democracy Now!, and she said, "That sounds great. Why don't you do it?" And you at the time did not have a lot of radio experience, correct?
I had never. Well, you did your homework. Yeah, that is true. I not only didn't have a lot of radio experience, I didn't really listen to the radio. I'd never heard of public radio. I'd never heard of community radio. It was just totally out of my sphere. But, you know, Amy said, you know, grab a tape recorder and do it yourself. And I did. And I was lucky enough to, when that story aired on our local community radio station here, WBAI, someone from NPR happened to be driving through New York and heard it and picked it up for a weekend, All Things Considered. And, you know, over a 24-hour period, my life kind of toppled upside down, and I was lucky, so lucky, at 22 to find my calling. And, you know, here we are many, many years later.
I'm wondering if that experience maybe was the genesis of you thinking it would be a good idea to turn the microphone over to people who are not necessarily professionals in broadcasting or journalism and let them take the ball and run with it in the form of StoryCorps or some other things that you've done.
You know, I have done maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of interviews, and no one has ever asked me that question. I've never thought about it, and it's brilliant. I've never thought about that. Yeah, I guess it's true. I was in every way just kind of a regular person when I was asking those questions, and I saw that I was able to do it. And, you know, it's not rocket science doing this stuff. Again, all it takes is, you know, you want to do a little bit of preparation. You know, you want to go in with the motives of helping other people and making people feel good by doing these interviews. You know, I think that in many ways the StoryCorps piece of opening this up and kind of turning documentary on its head in a way and saying that, you know, traditionally documentary has been about, you know, you go out and you record, you know, interviews with people, and the good that comes of it has to do with this product you create, which is a piece of art or, you know, education or whatever, which is this documentary, which entertains however many people or educates, you know, the audience, whether it's a public radio audience of thousands or tens of thousands or millions or film audiences. And the idea with StoryCorps kind of turned that on its head and said that there can be a value in the interview itself. You know, StoryCorps is built on this idea that two people having this conversation can change their lives and improve their relationship. So in many ways, StoryCorps is just a simple public service with the broadcast piece, just kind of a corollary and ancillary kind of piece of good that comes off of it. So, I mean, I think what I saw over the years when I started giving people tape recorders and having them record their own stories, which was kind of a documentary form that I started doing like maybe 20 years ago, I saw that actually talking to each other, that having a microphone gave people the license to have conversations they don't normally get to have and ask questions they don't normally get to ask. So, you know, I think in many ways it was the documentary work that led me to see the power and the kind of good that can come from people having these conversations with a microphone.
As you noted, the 10th anniversary of StoryCorps is this year. You'll be celebrating it in the fall.
Yes.
What has surprised you about this decade in terms of where StoryCorps started and where it's come to this point?
Well, when StoryCorps started 10 years ago, it was supposed to be a 10-year project. The idea, I thought that if we could survive for 10 years, we would be winding down now, and it would have been a, you know, a great experiment and served a bunch of people, I hoped. But, you know, about a year into the project, a year and a half into the project, I began to see the power of this thing. It's not rocket science. It's a very simple power of giving people the chance to have these conversations and how much it could mean in their lives, and decided to retire from making radio documentaries and devote the rest of my life to StoryCorps, to hopefully building it into a, you know, sustaining national institution that someday, we hope, will touch the lives of every American family. We're a very, 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 very long way from there. But, you know, I think that's, you know, the fact that it would completely overturn my life is one big surprise. And, you know, seeing the kind of impact that it has on people. You know, one of the secrets of StoryCorps is that when we started, and it's funny because the person who was driving over the whatever bridge when they heard that the original broadcast on Amy Goodman's newscast, who became my radio mentor, he used to work at NPR, a guy named Gary Covino. When I called him and told him about StoryCorps, he said, you know, I guess it's a good idea, but nobody's going to come. You know, and at the beginning, it was very hard to convince people to do this thing. But thanks to the broadcasts on, you know, local public radio stations and on NPR, people started to understand what we were doing and also reading about it in the news. And now, again, we can't nearly meet the interest in recording these interviews. So, you know, I think that, you know, we all here believe in StoryCorps and this idea that the voices of the people around us, as I said before, the power in those voices, the poetry and the wisdom, creating something in the media that is, you know, really about permanence and not the kind of disposable sort of media stuff that we see all the time. I mean, I think with all of the great advances in technology, you know, there are certain lessons that technology just will never be able to teach us. And one of those lessons is what we learned in StoryCorps, which is really about wisdom and connection. So, you know, I'm even more excited about StoryCorps than I was, you know, 10 years ago and more passionate about it. And I have a group of incredible people around me who feel the same way. So we're just very focused on moving into the future and continuing to do more public service and, you know, give more people the chance to participate and celebrate the real American story.
Do you have any idea yet of what the next special project a la Military Voices may be?
Yeah, we're going to launch an LGBT project in June of 2014. So I don't think I've talked about that anywhere before here, but that's going to happen. That'll be the next big national initiative. And as far as what comes after that, we're not sure yet.
David, I say thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you, Gordon. And again, as I said, it's a privilege to be at WMUK, where this Military Voices project really had its genesis and where it was born.
David Isay is the founder of StoryCorps. We spoke last week while StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative was collecting interviews in Kalamazoo. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Later this month, the World Transplant Games will begin in Durban, South Africa. Organ transplant recipients will participate in sports such as track and field, swimming, and cycling in the week-long competition. Among them will be David Rozelle, a retired professor of accountancy at Western Michigan University. David Rozelle, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
We've talked before about the fact that you are the recipient of a donated heart. People who have not heard this story or maybe have heard it and kind of forget the details, how did you end up needing a heart transplant?
In 1984, I had a very serious heart attack. They saved my life in Bronson Hospital. I thought I was damaged goods. Well, certainly I was damaged goods. That was obvious. But I didn't realize I was deteriorating. And slowly I did until I could no longer walk. I could no longer stand. So they sent me off to the U of M because a cardiologist here in Kalamazoo told me that there was nothing more they could do for me, that I had congestive heart failure and I would surely die within a year or two. And so you grasp at straws, and I was one of the lucky ones because most people don't get a transplant, even if they need one, and I did, and I've thrived.
Before you had heart trouble, were you someone who was physically active, stayed in shape? Did you participate in running sports, those sort of things?
No. I entered on my own feet, the emergency room at Old Bronson Hospital, on a Sunday afternoon, and I said, I'm a male, I'm over 40, I'm overweight, and I smoke, and I have chest pain. And they said, get on that gurney over there, and We'll hook up the oxygen and the glycerin. And if you feel you're going to pass out, you yell. So I did, and I did. That's when this big attack came on, but I was fortunate it's where I was. If I would have been 5 minutes later, it wouldn't have been, it'd been a much different story.
So when you got your heart transplant, were you thinking about physical activity at all, or were you just thinking, I've got this heart, I'm just happy that I'm still walking the earth?
Well, my first impression, which I had formed even before I got it, is that I would be semi-invalid. And it was a couple of months afterwards before I realized that, you know, I was better than I had ever been. And while I wasn't fully recovered, I certainly knew that I was in a new place. And so that I worked very hard to get back to school here at Western by that following September. So in direct answer to your question, my big thing was to get back to work, to get back to a normal kind of life. That was loomed very large with me, and I didn't think about it in terms of becoming more physical, though even they had me walking 3 miles. They wanted me to walk 2 miles every other day, and what I did is I walked 3 miles every day. Maybe that helped my recovery, maybe it didn't, but that's what I did. And so the way I got to running is when someone pointed out to me that 3 miles was sort of like a 5K, so you ought to try that. And so I ran in my first 5K here at Western in the homecoming run. I didn't have any running shoes. I ran with my Rockports on, and I made it, just barely. So that kind of set the tone. I kept trying and kept entering 5Ks. I bought some running shoes, and so it's been a great adventure.
Did you ever have any concern that with a transplanted heart, something was going to go wrong, or you weren't quite up to being able to do a 5K run, any of those things?
I didn't see it that way. And some people that I have run against have accused me of being ahead of the, of having an advantage. We don't have an advantage. A new organ is never as good as the old one was when it was really good. But nonetheless, some people say, well, yeah, I'd do better if I had a new heart. So.
But in reality, it's not.
I was so struck by how much better I felt, and I was I was sick for a long time, so I kind of forgotten what it felt like to feel real good, and so I never thought that there was any barrier to anything I did.
So now the World Transplant Games are being held in Durban, South Africa. You've participated before, correct?
I've been to two U.S. games in alternating years. We have the U.S. games and then we have the World games. So I've done two U.S. games and I did the World games 2 years ago in Sweden. And so now I'm off to South Africa to try to do it again. It's all age group sort of competition from very quite young children. And then in at least in the World games, 10-year increments up to 70 and over. So that's the highest age group.
What sport are you participating in?
Well, I'll run the 5K, and then I'll go and run something else in the track competition. I think this year I'm running the 400 meters, not because I'm particularly fast. It has a lot to do with the timing of the events. Traditionally, there's an opening event, and the opening event in these transplant competitions is always the 5K. So even before the opening ceremony, which is a high point as it is in the Olympics, we have already run. And so then you're there for the week watching your fellows swim and run and throw and participate in all the other sports. I particularly watch cycling. But so I always wanted to have something else to do later in a week of my own. And so I took to entering some track event. It doesn't matter much what it is. There won't be a lot of us in my age group because we are the senior age group, I guess. But there'll be a few of us, and we'll compete in something later.
Do you think an event like this raises more awareness about organ donation?
It seems to. The organizing committees have insisted that it does, and the way they can measure this is, of course, as everybody else, you measure the inches of publicity you get. I guess that's kind of old-fashioned, the inches, but maybe the minutes of exposure you get on television and other mass media. But The other measure we have is how many people register to be an organ donor or a potential organ donor, because most of us never will be. Register, and here in Michigan, for example, we register with the Secretary of State's office. And the organizers insist that there are perceptible upticks in registrations in the communities where these events are held, of the order of 25 or 30%.
You say most of us will never be organ donors because we're going to presumably live to a point where we're too old to have our organs harvested.
No, it isn't too old. That's a kind of a misconception. Mm. We've actually had a donor in Michigan who was 100 years old.
Really?
In fact, I think a little older. The eliminating factor, kind of grotesque, but it's the way we pass away. We have to go in such a way that our organs are still very healthy, very vital, getting oxygen, being perfuse with blood, so that they're useful to the recipient. That happens so rarely that we actually pass on that way. In kind of layman's terms, if you don't die on event, there's a very good chance you won't be an organ donor. Well, in fact, it's almost impossible, except on event. Because what the ventricular devices do is keep the blood and oxygen going to the organs, even though perhaps we're, for example, my donor was brain dead. And that makes for a perfect donor. There are six of us alive today because of the way that that young man passed away and the courage of the family to allow them to recover those organs from that young man.
It was a car accident for him?
It was a car accident, and I hasten to add this. This was a teenager in which he wasn't at fault at all. And he was going from his high school to his job at McDonald's when he was hit by an older man who had his license suspended four times already. That ended up being a blessing to six of us, but out of a terrible tragedy for a family.
Does having something like the World Transplant Games, you have all these athletes participating, you know, being very active and athletic, does it also show people what is possible on the other side? You know, you mentioned that you thought you would be semi-invalid when this was all over, and a lot of people who might think about an organ transplant might have the idea that even if they get a new heart, they're not going to be able to do much, and they might even question whether it's worth going through it. Does something like the World Transplant Games show that, yeah, it's worth the effort?
Yes. In fact, I think that was the original modifying 20 years ago, well, about 23 years ago now. That was the motivational factor for the organization of the games, to prove that it really works. And you're right. I'm not the only one who was off on the wrong track, really, in my own thoughts. I recently spoke to a gentleman here in Michigan who his family urged me to contact because he thought that along the lines I had, he's in middle age, and he said, what good would it do me to go through the trauma of a transplant and gain another 6-7 years? And, of course, that's not what happens. And transplant games are to prove that that's not what happens.
How long has it been since your transplant?
I'll be 12 years in October.
So a healthy dozen already.
Yeah, a healthy dozen already, and I was transplanted fairly late in life. So I've always said I doubt I could be the transplant who lived the longest, but I could be the one who lived to be the oldest. So there's still an opening for me, and I'm still pursuing that.
David Rozelle, thank you very much for your time, and good luck in South Africa. Hope you enjoy the World Transplant Games.
I'm sure I will, and I thank you.
David Rozelle is a retired professor of accountancy at Western Michigan University. He is participating in the World Transplant Games, which begins Sunday in Durban, South Africa. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.